course, the first item on our agenda tonight is our debate. And the proposition is now that a large plane was destroyed at the Pentagon. In the affirmative position, we have back for a second appearance, Wayne Huffy, and he will succeed in just a minute or two to get my timer out here with the affirmative position. One moment, please. All right, Wayne, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Time starts now. Go ahead.
Okay, so thank you. In this presentation, I'll go over the events at the Pentagon with a focus on the zombie myths that have persisted. Some of these myths were repeated during the last debate. Paying attention is the only way to destroy a zombie myth. So let's begin, and I hope you all have the slides. Slide 5, a tree at column 16 will be used as a reference point. This may be new information to most of you. The tree is immediately to the right of the impact point at column 16. Immediately after the impact, only a fractured stump remains, apparently severed upon impact. The upper portion was dragged into the 80-foot hole in the wall by the wing and then the rear stabilizers. The tree was not blown outward onto the pristine lawn, so this helps prove that the wall was not destroyed by both the...
I'm going to pause your time, Wayne. Can you just turn the call, please?
Mike Cook.
Who?
Mike Cook, sorry.
How do you spell the last name?
C-double-O-K.
Okay, and which group are you with, Mike? Mike, what is your affiliation?
Architects and Engineers.
Oh, thank you. Okay. All right. And Roger, welcome. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. Wayne, you may proceed. I paused your time. Go ahead.
So the tree was not blown out onto the pristine lawn, so this helps prove that the wall was not destroyed by explosives from the inside. I will point out this stump many times in the following presentation. Slide 6 shows the tree from an aerial view before 9/11. Slide 7 shows the tree location in front of column 16. This tree would have impacted the wing between the fuselage and the engine, thus sheltering column 16 from some of the impacting forces, helping explain why column 16 experienced less damage than the neighboring columns. Will people please go on mute? Please go on mute. Slide 8 shows the stump.
Star 6 to mute, everybody. Star 6 to mute your phone so that you're not interfering. Wayne, I paused your time. You can proceed. Go ahead.
All right. Well, this section takes me six and a half minutes, so I'm going to finish it. Slide 8 shows the stump in the photo after the wall collapses. Slide 11, it's a zombie myth, and I'll leave this the next exercise for the students. Slide 12, the hole was too small for a large aircraft. Last month, the debater was emphatic that the hole in the first floor wall was no more than 50 feet. It was argued that column 15 rises from a slab and is angled outward and defines the extent of the opening. Slide 15, from this picture, in the circles, you can see fire behind the suspended columns 14, 15, and 16. This shows that these columns' remnants are suspended from above. Slide 17. This shows that the 80-foot opening, after the fire was extinguished, the hanging columns 15, 16, and 17 can be seen. But moving on to slide 18. This slide shows that if these columns were, in fact, rising from the floor, they would need to originate under the middle of the windows as shown in the dotted lines. Therefore, these cannot be rising from the floor slab and angled outwards. Slide 21. This photo zooms in on column 16, and you can see the object in the front of the bottom of column 16 is, in fact, the shattered tree stump. Slide 22. This is column 5G. It is suspended from the second floor by just the rebar, just like column 16. Slide 26. This shows the interior damage. For the columns that were not destroyed, you can see that many of them are bowed in the direction of the plane's impacting momentum. Slide 27, zombie myth number 3, says that there's no significant aircraft debris visible outside. After the fireball, witnesses said there were millions of small pieces of wreckage and debris at and around the heliport. Slide 28 shows the trajectory of the debris when the momentum in the northerly direction is accounted for. Nothing goes to the south. Slide 29, if there was an internal explosion that destroyed the first floor wall and exploded outward, debris and the tree at column 16 would have been blown onto the pristine lawn. but remnants of the tree are not visible in any photos of the lawn. Slide 31. This shows the debris on the lawn, looking from the heliport, looking towards the road. Slide 32. This shows the beginning of the afternoon debris pickup. The man with the FBI jacket is holding an American Airlines fragment that was addressed in Zombie Myth Number 1. Zombie Myth Number 4. There are wildly inconsistent witness accounts. While details differ, most report a single aircraft flying towards the Pentagon, followed by an explosion and fireball. Distant witnesses reported the complete event from a safe vantage point. No flyover was reported. No wild banking or turning of the plane was reported that would have been required for the CIT's North Pass maneuvering. Slide 35. Mike Walters was in the traffic jam outside the Pentagon. He says, I looked out my window and I saw this plane coming. It slammed right into the Pentagon. Huge explosion, great ball of fire, smoke started billowing up. Slide 36, Daryl Donnelly's statement. I looked up to see the entire plane next to my car, through my passenger window a short distance away. I watched the plane fly into the Pentagon. I heard the crunching sound of the plane disintegrating as it slammed into the building at ground level. The plane disappeared into the building as a massive fireball erupted, engulfing one side of the Pentagon. I felt the heat. Slide 38. This shows where three remote witnesses observed the plane impact. Slide 39. The interview with Don Chauncey. Announcer, you witnessed what happened at the Pentagon. What did you see? Don Chauncey. It came in at a high rate of speed. It increased its speed as it got closer to the Pentagon. Then I saw a big yellow ball of fire. Slide 40. Interview with Don Wright. Don Wright. Yes, I watched what looked like a commuter plane, two engine, come down from the south, real low, proceed right on and crash into the Pentagon. Don Wright. Yes, or a newscaster, went directly into the Pentagon? Don Wright, yes, that's correct. Slide 41, Deb Onliff was in the Sheraton Hotel. Suddenly, this plane was right outside my window. It shot straight across from where we are and flew right into the Pentagon. It was just this huge fireball that crashed into the wall. Slide 42, Zombie Myth Number 5. Aerodynamic forces called ground effect would prevent a plane from getting any closer to the ground than one half of its wingspan above the ground while flying at high speed, which means no lower than the fourth floor. Thank you. Slide 43. In the lower part of this slide, you'll see the glide path descending toward the Pentagon. By looking at the dotted line below it, you can see that the plane was no more than one-half wingspan above the ground until just before the plane struck the light pole. Then, with damaged wings producing less lift and therefore less ground effect, the plane continues into the Pentagon wall. Within the last 1,500 feet, the additional lift from the ground effect alters the plane's downward trajectory. Yes, ground effect does have some impact with the plane. The ground effect pushes the plane up, and the ground effect keeps it above the lawn. The plane did not pop up to the fourth floor like an ejection seat once it crossed Route 27 and suddenly found itself less than one-half wingspan above the ground. It wasn't an ejection seat. Slide 44, I guess it is, shows another picture of the glide path that from another direction. And by the way, the lower image shows that the impact of that the level flight path in the video camera can't be accounted for with
time.
Right.
Time.
And in a photo on slide 47, slide 46, this photo shows a 747 flying at high speed above a landing strip, 16% of its wingspan. Slide 47, the photo shows an A380 flying at high speed.
You're at time, okay?
Well, this is that was the end. In summary, how do you kill a zombie myth? By listening. This concludes my constructive segment.
Thank you, Wayne. Okay. Craig and Adam, are you ready to go?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Your time starts now. You'll be taking the negative. Go ahead.
Most in the truth movement agree that no plane piloted by Al-Qaeda crashed into the Pentagon, but a debate persists about whether any plane impact occurred. In this presentation, we'll prove that no plane was destroyed and why it matters. On 9/11, we were asked to believe that the Twin Towers were destroyed because of plane impacts and fires. Flight 93 crashed into a field and disappeared underground, and Flight 77 crashed into the first floor of the Pentagon without a single large piece of wreckage being visible at the crash scene. Why does it matter? Well, clear evidence of a faked plane crash at the Pentagon on 9/11 is critical for proving that this was a false flag operation involving the U.S. government because no other entity could have staged this crime scene. Since clear proof of an impact has not been produced, the burden of proof is on those who believe it occurred. Now, you might ask, can't the Pentagon event be an inside job even if we support an impact? Well, yes, it can, but when we discard some of our most powerful evidence, the case against the official story is much weaker. Now, to the witnesses, James Miggs, formerly of Popular Mechanics, says hundreds saw an American Airlines jet hit the Pentagon. Some say 180 saw an impact. Both are false. To know who saw what, we have to look at what the witnesses actually said. Some made up claims that did not stand up. Stephen McGraw, for instance, was quoted as saying he saw a light pole clipped, but when questioned by Citizen Investigation Team's Aldo Marquis, he admitted, "I didn't actually see the light pole go over or anything. No." In Ken Jenkins' The Pentagon Plane Puzzle, a woman identified as Janet is asked whether she saw a plane crash into the Pentagon. "Yes, sir, I did. I just saw the plane disappear out of my sight beyond the trees, and then I just saw massive billows of smoke." In the most complete analysis yet, researcher One Slice Short starts with 239 alleged witnesses. Then he eliminates those who were inside the Pentagon, could not see the Pentagon, and who could not see the point of impact, among other categories. And we are left with 41 potential impact witnesses. But even among those, details vary widely. And that figure includes numerous witnesses who contradict the official flight path. One of the 41 is Steve Storti, who says he saw a plane hit, and that's flight 14, who says he saw a plane hit and even people moving around in the plane from his balcony 3/4 of a mile away, and you can see the arrow pointing to the Pentagon, which is impossible. But some witnesses were extremely credible. CIT conducted interviews near the Pentagon and found more than a dozen highly credible witnesses who saw a plane approach on a different flight path. The almost identical flight path they described was to the north of the Citgo gas station, and you can see on slide 16 what they drew in yellow. On-camera interviews in CIT's National Security Alert were very high quality. They were clear, thorough, and transparent. Despite these witnesses believing a plane hit, they described a flight path that doesn't match the damage. Unless all the north of Citgo witnesses are mistaken or lying in exactly the same way, then the government's plane impact scenario cannot be true. Now, here's a quote from Massimo Mazzucco, the creator of September 11, the new Pearl Harbor. He says, "The work that Craig Ranke of CIT has done on the witnesses for the North Pass is some of the most solid, irrefutable evidence that one could ever assemble on 9/11, period." Are these witnesses credible? Slide 22. You have to watch the video and judge for yourself. Now to the flight data recorder. There is no way, through serial numbers, to link the FDR to Flight 77 or any other plane, so it can't be used to support an impact. However, it is reasonable to point out that this evidence, offered by the government to substantiate its own official story, actually refutes it. So either the FDR data were fabricated, which proves inside job, or they were genuine, which also proves inside job. On slide 27, we see the NTSB simulation, taken from the alleged FDR data, at 1 second to alleged impact with an altitude of 180 feet, much too high to hit the building or the light poles. The FDR says the plane was at 699 feet above sea level as it passed the VDOT antenna, but descending in time to level out and hit the five poles would create G-forces far beyond the capability of a 757. Now, to slide 30, it's hard to imagine that anyone could believe that a plane the size of a 757 could cause this little damage to the facade and yet still not leave a single large piece of wreckage outside. Where did the wings and tail go? If the right engine hit column 17, why is it still partially standing? Why are the windows above the second floor opening unbroken? Column 14 was still intact on the second floor where the fuselage is supposed to have entered. And since we're told that the alleged plane would have lost structural integrity by the time it was halfway to the C-ring hole, then what created this hole? And you can see that on slide 33. And what happened to the two engines? Who were these guys, and why were they placing or moving evidence, tainting the crime scene before any investigation had started? Scientists A.K. Dewdney and G.W. Longspaugh studied what would have happened if the wings of a 757 had hit the Pentagon wall. And here's a quote from that. "The wings would fail as soon as the force of impact exceeded the elastic limit of the material. If they did not fail, and if the support columns did not give way, the only remaining possibility would be for the aircraft to remain almost entirely outside the Pentagon." Now, the light poles were valuable to the perpetrators because they appear to establish trajectory, altitude, and minimum wingspan. And on slide 43, we see no one reported seeing this, but taxi driver Lloyd England says this pole pierced his windshield without even scratching or denting the hood. He claims he and a stranger removed the 240-pound pole, and you can see England's diagram there. In the next, we see a scratch indicated by the arrows that appears to have been made by the pole being dragged into place.
1 minute.
Now, to the video evidence, frames from the two Pentagon cameras were synchronized using a multiplexer system, and about 100 frames were common to both sets and matched each other perfectly. All but the one that allegedly shows 757 crossing the Pentagon lawn. So this frame was doctored either in one set of frames or both. So to conclude, any one of the following would make a persuasive case no plane hit the Pentagon or was destroyed at the Pentagon. The accounts of the North of Sitka witnesses, the disappearance of the wings, tail, and stabilizers, the alleged FDR data, the provably faked video, the searing hole that has no rational explanation. Put this and much more together, and the case that no plane was destroyed at the Pentagon is overwhelming. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, we move on to our rebuttal time. Rebuttals must be totally focused on refuting evidence presented by your opponent. Are you ready, Wayne?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Let's take a look at the two witnesses that were highlighted in Craig's slides 9 and 14. I'll touch on the misleading comments about these witnesses. From the quotes presented, it is clear that they are attempting to impugn the credibility of Father Stephen McGraw, a witness to the plane impact, by implying that he was forced to retract his testimony about seeing the light pole go over under questioning. In fact, he never saw it go down. From slide 9, our listeners would have thought that McGraw gave testimony about seeing the light poles go down. In fact, the light pole was an incidental comment that, as you will see from the entire quote from that day. Here's what he said. I was in the left-hand lane with my windows closed. I did not hear anything at all until the plane was right above our cars. McGraw estimates that the plane passed about 20 feet over his car as he waited in the left-hand lane of the road on the side closest to the Pentagon. The plane clipped the top of a light pole just before it got to us, injuring a taxi driver whose taxi was just a few feet away from my car. I saw it crash into the building, he said. My only memories were that it looked like a plane coming in for a landing. I mean, in that sense, it was a controlled and sort of straight. That was my impression, he said. So, that was his testimony about observing a plane crash. The light pole was an incidental comment. It actually came from behind. The plane came from behind, and he wasn't even looking in its direction. He never saw it go down. However, in documenting how memories change after the fact, may be CIT's greatest contribution to the 9/11 truth movement, a fact that should concern anyone who listens to the CIT witness testimony 8 years after 9/11, taken after 8 years after 9/11. For example, at 5:20, in the Lloyd England accomplice video, McGraw talks about changing his memory after hearing other people say things. He says, I have a memory that was revived after the fact of the plane bouncing on the lawn before it went into the building. That came to me after hearing other witness testimonies that had supported that the plane had bounced and that it had hit the ground before it crashed into the building. When I heard that, it provoked something. I thought, yes, that's the image. It came back to me more after they said that. Well, that's my impression, that it hit the ground first. But as we all know, there are no marks from a bouncing plane on the pristine lawn. This shows that statements may change significantly after the fact. This is a problem that CIT supporters need to recognize. Moving on to slide 14, entitled False Accounts of the Impact. You've also attempted to impugn the credibility of Steve Storty by stating that while Storty said he saw the plane hit the Pentagon from his balcony 3/4 of a mile away, he could also see people moving around in the plane. Impossible from where he was, you say. Well, there are two issues to raise here. First, in the initial witness testimony, he never mentioned seeing people inside the plane. He watched the plane cross over Route 395, tip its left wing as it passed the Navy Annex, veer sharply, and then slice into the Pentagon. I remember thinking that whoever's flying this knows what they're doing, Storty said. The plane traveled straight as an arrow. It didn't waver, it didn't flip from side to side. Storty watched the plane silently glide into the Pentagon like a car entering a garage. However, at 7:10 in the audio interview on the CIT website, Steve explains his comment about moving people. I know this because the plane was low enough that I could see through the window, and I could see light on the other side of the plane all the way back until the final third of the plane, at which point some of the windows stayed blacked out because other windows, I'm not going to say shadows or silhouettes, but because they weren't that clear, but things were moving back and forth. That's all I have for now.
Thank you. Okay, let me reset this. Okay, are you ready for your rebuttal, Craig and Adam?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to pass this over to Adam in a second, but I want to start by saying that Wayne says zombie myths are continually resurrected without merit. I find this to be condescending and insulting. He says that the only way to kill these myths is to pay attention or to listen, which is little more than an ad hominem attack. Wayne's use of the term reminds me of a poker player who bluffs when he has nothing in his hand. I think zombie myths is pure debunker language and playing the debunker game of commenting unfairly on the psychology of those who have a different opinion. It's not about psychology or confirmation bias, it's about evidence. And I'm going to pass over to Adam, but one quick statement I'm going to make about slide 14 is, if you look at that slide and you tell me that he could see light and dark in the windows of the plane, then I think that's nuts. Anyway, over to you, Adam.
Okay, we list five so-called zombie myths, which make up the core of his argument. He fails, however, to recognize that he's promoting a stubborn myth himself by claiming that there are 180-plus witnesses who support his arguments. We challenge both the number of witnesses Wayne claims and what side of this argument they really support. Right now, though, I'll address the first three of Wayne's zombie myths. The first is completely irrelevant to our case. The second is that the hole in the Pentagon is too small to fit a large airliner. Wayne's using a straw man argument here when he says that some people believe the hole was only 16 feet wide, and therefore they believe it had to have been a missile or a bomb. We're not saying it is a 16-foot wide hole. In fact, we're not arguing about the size of the hole at all. We're simply contesting what caused it. We contend that explosives were used to simulate the crash damage and create the hole. As Craig said before, the wings, the tail, and the vertical stabilizers do not fit into this hole. The windows were intact in the area where the tail would have struck, and the rear stabilizers appear to have left no mark. If a 757 struck the Pentagon at a 42-degree angle, the total swath of damage would have been at least 160 feet wide. Since the opening in the first floor is only 80 feet, it's obvious that the hole really is too small to accommodate an airliner, and Wayne's claim is busted. The third zombie myth is that there are no significant pieces of debris visible outside. And Wayne, I have to say that you have a very different idea of what large pieces of debris are. To me, a large piece isn't something you could pick up with one hand and throw in the trunk of your car. You cite witnesses who made various claims about the debris, but failed to name them so we could address them properly. There are no significant pieces of debris shown in your own photographs. All the pieces in your photos are insignificant and represent a tiny fraction of the 757's total mass. We don't see stabilize the wings. Much of what be in slide 30 particularly appears to be rubble or tree debris or other unknown materials. And evidence that the crime scene was contaminated by dozens of individuals handling debris while the Pentagon was still smoldering. So we think it's very to have been planted. Now, the final two zombie myths I'll address in the next rebuttal period.
Okay. Thank you. We're now ready for a counter-rebuttal from Wayne to respond to the rebuttal of his opponent. Are you ready, Wayne?
Yes.
Go ahead.
So, first of all, I want to address the comment about zombie myths. What I'm doing here is talking about the physical evidence, the size of the hole. I never said it was 16 feet. That's a hole on the size of the top of the second story. It's a small opening. I'm talking about the 50-foot opening at the bottom where I'm talking about the columns. So you've apparently misrepresented that. So there is an 80-foot opening, and that's large enough to fit the bulk of the mass between the engines and the discussion about the wings, the impact of the wings. If you actually go through and look at the site that you referenced about the wings, the missing wings, you actually go take a look. There's an awful lot more information about the wings and how they would have collapsed. A plane can't just decelerate. Now, I want to go talk about the light poles and to some extent. So let's take a look at one of the witnesses that is on your list, George Amon. He's on George worked at the offices of the Arlington National Cemetery, where he was in a second-floor office that day. He had a clear view of the plane approach and the impact. He saw the plane, quote, over the naval annex, unquote, and impact the Pentagon wall. From his Center for Military History interview on page 6, you can get this off the CIT website, he says, George Amon, I'm just watching. I'm amazed at that it happened pretty quick, too, and it hit the thing, and it was just the most god-awful loudest noise. I mean, you could hear it like in a 3D. You could. I could see it. I could hear it. Bam. And then it could just hear it crumbling and crushing like an accordion, and then boom, boom, just like a smash, crunch, pow, when all the fuel blew up. So George Amon watched this. And if you go to page 19 of his testimony, the Center for Military History interviewer says, when you first saw it, from here to there, how long did it take? And George says, from here to over there, a matter of seconds. When I seen he was kind of turning and gliding, when he comes across here, across the parking lot, but when he got right out in front here, it sounded like he poured the coals on. Yes, that's when I looked over here, and when I was looking over here, I see things fly up, not knowing what the hell they were. But come to find out, they were streetlights. So the plane was clipping the tops off the streetlights. So even though you say that there are no credible witnesses, here's George Amon. He's a Southside witness because there are no references to any North Pass light pole damage. So George must have seen the light pole impacts that can only be associated with the South Pass. How many of you have read his entire testimony, right? So to me, there's a huge amount of body of evidence that you need to be able to address. The witnesses that... Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Wayne. Let's see, Craig and Wayne, you ready? Craig and Kevin, you ready for your comment at all?
Yeah.
Okay,
yep.
Go ahead.
Okay, before I hand it over to Adam, I just want to say in Wayne's fourth zombie myth, he claims witnesses were not wildly contradictory, but they were. And I have to say I'm amazed that he's using Mike Walter as a credible witness for impact. Next to Lloyd England, he is easily the least trustworthy Pentagon witness because his story keeps changing. At one point, he says the wings were sheared off. At another, he says they folded in. But in an interview with Bryant Gumbel of CBS, he says, you know, the there were trees that kind of obstructed it. So I saw it go in. So did he see it or not? Were the wings sheared off or did they fold in? He doesn't have any credibility whatsoever. Adam?
You know, as our slide number 60 shows, the interviews conducted by CIT represent the gold standard of quality we should all strive for in our own investigations. The witnesses used to support the impact narrative, however, don't appear to have been looked into according to any investigative standards at all. Very little follow-up has been done to verify anything they said. Daryl Donnelly, for example, said he was near the Pentagon, but we don't know exactly where. All we do know is where he was when he took some photos. Daryl said he ducked down in his car due to the sound of an incoming airliner, yet claims he was able to see out his passenger window and his driver's side window and pick out small details of what the plane looked like, even though the entire event would have been over within a few seconds. He claims he could see the backs of both engines in the split second after it passed over his car and, according to him, slammed into the Pentagon, all this while ducked down in fear. Deb Onloff was in the Sheraton Hotel, but her view of the damaged facade was completely blocked by the naval annex. She said she saw only, quote, a fireball crashing into the Pentagon. Don Wright was 2 miles away with a very doubtful view of the event, and he said it was a white commuter jet, which is wrong, and he said it came from the south, which is also wrong. Don Chauncey was well over 6 miles away and was not able to see the damaged facade at all. Don couldn't tell if the fireball he saw came from the airport or the Pentagon. Why Wayne considers Chauncey a valid witness is beyond me. But it's long past time that the truth movement makes the distinction between quality eyewitness testimony and the morass of questionable witnesses compiled by the anonymous entity Arabesque. Who is Arab Besk, and why do Chandler, Hoffman, Jenkins, and Ryan rely upon his unsourced witness compilation as though it's legitimate? Why do none of them directly address the in-person, on-camera, highly detailed interviews done by CIT? And why has Wayne avoided talking about these gold standard witnesses himself?
Okay. Both sides will now have one last brief opportunity for rebuttal. We'll start with Wayne. Are you ready, Wayne?
I guess so.
Go ahead.
So first, I have to say that I have looked into the witnesses that you say are gold standard. I just gave you once George Amon. George Amon is a Southside witness because he talked about the plane hitting the light pole. I'm astonished that you didn't go back and take a look at the testimony that he gave. CIT not only cherry-picks its witnesses, it cherry-picks what they say. So what else do you want me to say about them? You know, the gold standard in which you take a Southside witness and say he says he hits the light poles, and they're Northside witnesses. Looking out from his point of view in his office, he would have seen the naval annex to the left, and the plane would have been flying over his parking lot on the way to the plane, plane crashing into the side, and that's what he saw. That's what he reported. Your gold standard witness has just done you in. Right, and CIT's witnesses, if you're going to call them the gold standard, then
30 seconds.
Then, in fact, there's a lot more work that needs to be done. The wings, if you actually go back and take a look at the references to those, you'll see that it is quite possible for the wings, once they impact, to be the connection points to the plane to crush, and the wings would then go in as the momentum of the fuselage is pulling them into the Pentagon, into this first floor opening. Thank you.
Thank you, Wayne. Okay, Adam and Craig, you ready to proceed with your last rebuttal?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yes, okay.
Yes, we are. I think I take this one, Craig, correct?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wayne's Zombie Myth 5 attempts to disprove ground effects. To do this, Wayne posts two very deceptively labeled videos. He says illustrate high-speed, low passes. Yet neither one of these videos shows a high speed or a particularly low pass. In our view, Wayne has done nothing to address ground effects. Now, to address George Amon, I have indeed looked into his testimony, and he is very explicit in the interview he gives to CIT about the flight path of the plane, and he is a north of Sitgo witness, and as you know, if the plane was north of Sitgo, it is impossible for it to have struck the Pentagon. Craig, do you have anything?
Well, just when you refer to impugning witnesses, our point in bringing up these witnesses was not to impugn or not impugn. It was to point out how the reporting of what these witnesses' positions are can be very different once you actually follow up and investigate further. And if CIT had not investigated further in the case of Stephen McGraw, for example, we would have thought that he saw the light poles knocked over, which is something that he later admitted he didn't see. And this is something that your people on your side of the issue have claimed that he's a light pole witness. So, thank you.
Okay. Okay. So now we move on to our final summary. Each side has 2.5 minutes to make a final case. Wayne, you ready?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Begin. Okay, Craig and Adam have it wrong. Their slide 5 entitled Burden of Proof says clear proof of an impact has not been produced. The burden of proof is on those who believe it occurred. The proof that a large plane impact did occur is overwhelming, and those who question it have failed to prove anything of substance that it did not. They say that support of a large plane impact at the Pentagon should be considered to be an organized effort to steer the 9/11 truth movement away from some of the strongest evidence we have that 9/11 was an inside job. I disagree. The damage to the truth movement is from presenting unsubstantiated assertions as facts. The question about what happened to the tree at column 16 needs to be answered. Internal explosives, bombs, or missiles do not explain the tree's absence from the pristine lawn. Only the impact of a large plane dragging it inside can explain its absence. So then, is my support of the evidence-based observation of a large plane impact really synonymous with the official story that Hani Hunjour manually flew Flight 77 into the Pentagon after overpowering the pilots and taking everyone by surprise? It does not. Does supporting a large plane impact does not mean the large plane was Flight 77. It does not mean that the large plane was piloted by Hani Hunjour. It does not mean that the Pentagon command structure was taken by surprise. It doesn't mean that NORAD should be excused from its failure to respond with fighter planes. And it does not mean that we've thrown away some of the strongest evidence we have that 9/11 was an inside job. When I've gone back to the source materials of 9/11, I've heard people talk about explosions at the World Trade Center. The media stopped all that after the second day. When I've gone back to the original footage for the Pentagon, I've not heard any raw footage that clearly suggests an alternative to a large aircraft flying along Columbia Pike and striking the Pentagon. As you've heard here tonight, nothing from that day clearly supports the maneuvering required for the north of Sitco flight path. Planes need to maneuver. Such descriptions would have been prominent in the statements by witnesses. So confirmation bias, a desire to show that 9/11 was an inside job, apparently leads some to adopt wishful hypotheses that are not supported by the evidence, and then to ridicule those who have actually looked at all the evidence. The evidence is very supportive of a large plane impact. If you pay attention, you will see that zombie myths are logical dead ends. It is impossible to argue against a large plane impact on the south of Sitco flight path. I am hopeful that this debate will make a difference and encourage others to question their own confirmation bias. Thank you.
Thank you, Wolverine. Adam and Craig, you ready to proceed with your final summary?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
There's a troubling effort to steer 9/11 truth towards the plane impact at the Pentagon. A small group of researchers is devoting much time to producing scholarly papers, in quotes, and making presentations to convince us that most of the Pentagon official story is true, despite clear evidence to the contrary. In doing so, these individuals are much more closely aligned with the so-called debunkers than with the rest of the truth movement. They claim that their position is consistent with science, while opposing views are beliefs based on speculation. A couple of quick examples. Frank Legg tries to explain the lack of external debris by saying, quote, "The small size of most of the fragments would allow them to be hidden within the texture of the lawn," close quote. Just think about that one. James Miggs says the shredded plane would have passed through the Pentagon, quote, "in a state almost more like a liquid than a solid," unquote. And David Chandler says it would have moved, quote, "in a manner similar to the flow of a fluid," unquote. Why anyone in the truth movement would want to repeat such ludicrous claims is a mystery. Finally, there are 10 questions that impact supporters must be able to answer. Why would more than a dozen highly credible witnesses describe a virtually identical north of Sitco flight path, unless that is what they saw? Since we know the wings, tail section, and horizontal stabilizers did not penetrate, why weren't they lying on the lawn? How could the plane have entered through a hole much smaller than required without leaving large pieces of wreckage outside? Why was there no significant damage to the wall or even to the windows that would have been hit by the tail and stabilizers? How could the fuselage penetrate to the C-ring if the wings and tail section were turned to confetti on impact? How could the tiny amount of debris around the helipad possibly represent tons of aircraft wreckage? What happened to the virtually indestructible engine cords, and why didn't they create two exit holes? Given that the plane would have been ripped apart halfway to the C-ring hole, what can account for the hole? Why were all the synchronized frames from the two cameras identical, camera views, identical, except for the single frame that is supposed to show a plane? And finally, why would the government fake video of the crash if an actual crash took place? If they can't answer these, then they have no case. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig, Adam, and Wayne, for a very professional and certainly provocative presentation of your views on this question. We will now proceed with a 20-minute question and answer period. Questions and answers will be limited to 1 minute. I'll go ahead and take a stack of people that would like to ask questions. Who would like to be on the stack?
Adam Syed.
Dave
Schlesinger. Is that Barbara?
Yes.
Okay, who else?
Dave Schlesinger.
Dave Schlesinger.
Did you get Adam Syed?
Adam Syed, who else? Barry Zwicker. Barry, who else? Barbara, Dave Schlesinger, Ann Syed, and Barry. Anybody else?
James Huffer.
James,
Paul Zarenka.
Paul Zarenka. Who else? Okay, Paul, I got you. Who else?
Dick Atley.
Dick, who else? I'll put myself last. Go ahead, Barbara. Give me 1 minute.
Okay, these are comments or rebuttals.
Robin, I'll put you on the stand.
And Tim?
Tim.
Tim, okay. I'll put you, go ahead, Barbara. I'll put your time over. Go ahead.
Okay. I just would like to point out, now that we've heard the debate, that Craig and Adam did not debate the proposition of this debate, which was supposed to have been that no plane was destroyed at the Pentagon, not that it didn't hit the wall where the official story claimed. Okay, so that's point number one. And I really object to that. I really think that that should have been caught by the moderator and they'd be required to debate the proposition. But I was glad to see that Craig and Adam very strongly debated the proposition that I debated successfully 20-3 last time. And that is that the official story that a large 757-sized or large plane hit, as the official story alleged, impact point in Wedge 1. They, like me, have debated against that very successfully. I would like to say that in slide 51, the conclusion of Adam and Craig's presentation in their PowerPoint, it states, quote, "No plane destroyed the Pentagon is a complete non sequitur to all of the evidence and arguments."
Time's up, Barbara. Okay. Thank you for your comment. Okay. Dave, question?
Yes, I have a question for both sides. For Wayne, the two planes that you're shown flying close to the ground, how can you prove that they're actually going at high speed? And to Craig and Adam, did you address at all the tree that I had never heard of that Wayne raised?
Okay, thank you for your question. Let's see, Wayne, you have a minute to respond first. Go ahead.
Yeah, so Dave, good questions. You can, when you get the PowerPoint, you can actually click on the links. They are, the argument that we've heard, the assertion, the zombie myth we've heard is a plane can't get down below a half of its wingspan, can't get below the fourth floor of the Pentagon. So that's busted. There's pictures of them. They're not going 500 miles an hour. But they are within 6% of wingspan, so that gets you pretty darn close.
Speed is irrelevant.
Speed is. We are actually discussing whether how important that is. But you also have to remember, if you look at my slides 44, 43, 44, 45, that they are within half a wingspan only for the last 1,500 feet, and you're not going to have these. The ground effect is our forces. It's not like an ejection seat that's going to push you up to the fourth floor instantly. Right? It's just going to say, "Ooh, got to go up." And in fact, the plane does level out and change its the altitude, the attitude.
Okay.
So it is being forced up. So
excellent. Craig and Adam, you have a minute to respond to Dave's question, too.
Okay, Craig, can I step in here?
Absolutely. Yes.
First of all, to address Barbara.
No. You have to respond to David at this point. David asked you guys a question.
Okay. About the tree. Okay.
Tree.
Well, first of all, Wayne asserts that the tree was dragged inside. However, if you look at his own slide number 30, you can see that there are tree branches and leaves in the foreground of that photo. So I don't think there's any proof that the plane was dragged inside. There was debris all over the place, and I think it's erroneous to claim that the tree was dragged inside. But in regards to the ground effect, if you look at Wayne's second video, it shows a plane at moderate speed that appears to be struggling just to get down to 32 feet off the ground. And the ground effect appears to be affecting that plane quite a bit. So if you look at that video, you will see that ground effect is a real phenomenon, and it would have affected the plane.
Okay, thank you. Adam Syed, next.
Hi. This is this isn't so much a question, but just an observation, something that to Wayne came up. I noticed that in your first rebuttal, you sort of took Craig and Adam and the CIT side of this argument to task over the issue of Father McGraw and how, you know, he has a quote in which he mentions the light pole being clipped, but then later on CIT dug, and but then he said, well, when you go back and look at, you know, the original claim, he never actually said he saw with his own eyes the light pole get clipped. He just simply merely mentioned it. But Wayne, what you have to understand here is that going all the way back to 2007 or so, people on your side of this issue, I mean, Arabesque and Jim Hoffman, Victoria Ashley, Frank Legg, and a few other online bloggers, have all used this guy's testimony as evidence that he's a light pole witness, and that's why it's brought up.
Wayne, would you like to respond?
Well, if they are using him as a light pole witness, seeing it, then, in fact, that is erroneous. I had to actually go and pay $2.95 to get the copy of the article from the Providence Journal. I think this is the one, but to actually get the whole quote. And so the plane came. He was going north. The plane came from the south, went over him. The light poles would have been hit behind him. It is incorrect to use them. Use Father McGraw as a light pole witness, except there are white light poles that are down. And he never, in anything I've seen, says he actually saw the light poles get hit, because he was looking in the opposite direction. So,
yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Wayne. All right. Next is Barry Hooker. 1 minute, Barry. Go ahead.
I would just ask about this slide 47 that Wayne puts up showing the Lufthansa plane. And I think we've all been to air shows, and I wonder if anybody, including Wayne, can explain how a high-speed low pass would be done with the landing gear out.
Well, so I guess I've got a reply. This is, in fact, if you go to watch the video, this is a plane coming in. It's a high-speed. The flaps aren't down, and it proceeds to go and continue on after a ways, go back up into the air, and I think this one goes and turns around. So I don't know quite what the point is. But if I was trying to fly one of these things, I'd want to make sure I had wheels down to get down this close. Ground effect will keep you buoyant, as I understand it, but it's not a fail-safe, and for insurance purposes, I'm glad that they had the wheels down. I don't know. Did I answer your question?
No, because I've been to lots of air shows, and I never saw a high-speed pass of any kind where the landing gear was out.
Well, I invite you to go watch the video. That's all I can say. I wanted to show you that this plane did get down within 6% of the wingspan, and it's moving at a really quick. So it's up to you to take a look and look into the whole issue a little bit more. Thanks.
Sorry, Barry. That's it. We might make another stack if we have a few more minutes, but I don't think we do. James, you're next. 1 minute. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, my question was had to do with the tree, and I think it was. At least satisfactorily covered. So.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, James. Thanks for sharing the time. Okay. And Paul?
Yes. This is toward Wayne. I will tell you that the thing that impressed me about CIT is that before they analyzed what anybody said about anything, they checked whether they were in the position to make a statement or not, okay? And those 13 witnesses that they identified who were in a position to make a statement are on page 60 of slide 60 of Adam and Craig's presentation. Now, you'll notice that, this is to you, Wayne, you'll notice that Don Chancy is on a negative side of that. Now, The thing that struck me, that astonished me, is that the CIT station is a quarter mile from the Pentagon. This guy is 24 times further away. He's 6 miles away. 6 miles is a huge distance. I don't understand why you even put him on the slide. Apart from what he said.
So I'll tell you why I put it on there. Part of the CIT, and I thought was going to be Adam and Craig's position, was that there was going to be a flyover. So, you know, because people saw the plane. So what happened to it? If there's no plane, what happened to it? So what I did is I showed three, and a fourth, if you count George Amon, witnesses that say from a distance, that from a safe distance, they saw the plane come and impact. Now, Chauncey could see the side where it was impacting, but he didn't report a flyover. Neither did Don Wright, neither did Deb Onloff, neither did anybody else, except Roosevelt Roberts, who looked towards National, saw a plane flying around and turned around and went back someplace. That's the only reference on that day to something that could have possibly have been a flyover. But
Thank you.
That's there's a serious misstatement of fact that I have to say something about.
No, okay. So
a very serious misstatement of a fact. Don Chauncey was on the opposite side of the Pentagon, and he did not see damaged side.
Who is speaking?
That was Adam Wright.
That's Adam Wright.
Oh. Well, okay, I guess you guys have a chance to respond. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just want to point out that Don Chauncey was on the opposite side of the Pentagon that was struck. He could not see the damaged facade. So that's a very serious misstatement of a fact.
No. What I had said was I was using him to show that there was no witness to a flyover. People from a distance no one saw a flyover. Don Chauncey, Don Wright, no flyover. That was the point. I'm sorry you didn't hear that. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, I think that portion was clear. Okay.
Said twice during the debate that he saw impact.
Adam, please. Thank you. Dick Atley is next. Yeah, 1 minute, Dick.
Okay. I would like to find out from Craig and Adam whether the table on page 60 is just an isolated thing or whether there's a real large evaluation. Various things, whether this is just for the debate or whether someone actually has constructed something with a lot of the witnesses, which would be great. And in terms of number 65 in Wayne's presentation, talking about the Northwest Airlines event, which had come up in the previous debate and looks a little strange, it would be, I would think, quite easy for someone to do a computer model of the two different situations, Northwest at its speed and hitting the light pole, and American Airlines supposedly hitting the light pole, and it should be fairly easy to tell whether wings would have come off under those circumstances. I mean, it's a simple physics issue that a computer model could handle. So I'm sort of surprised it hasn't been done unless someone's heard of it. The only other point is that...
I'm sorry, that's all you have time for.
Okay.
I'm sorry, we were doing that. So, Wayne, do you want to respond to that?
Okay, I'll address the table. That's a work in progress. I'm trying to add a lot more witnesses, but for the purposes of this debate, I only put in the ones that Wayne was referring to and the ones we're referring to. But it does illustrate, like for example, in the case of Don Chauncey, that he had no view of the impacted facade.
Okay, thanks. Because we're so short on time, I'm going to cross my name off the list. Robin, do you have a minute? Go ahead.
There was a question to me about the Northwest. If you go take a look at the construction of the wings on the Boeings, what you'll find is that there's a very strong front spar that weighs a lot, and so if impacting the light pole would have been much a much more rigid wing than the DC-9 that was on the Northwest 250 flight 255. I've wanted to look into a little bit more in more detail, but I didn't have the time. But the requirements have gotten stiffer. In the early 60s, there were design changes and requirements for hitting, impacting things that affected the design of the 757 and later planes that wasn't available on the DC-9. So that's all I have. I don't have anything solid, but that's my understanding. Thanks.
Thank you, Wayne. Okay, so I take myself off the list, and I ask Robin and Tim in return to be as brief as possible because we're running out of time here. Robin, go ahead.
Yes, I second the point that the term zombie has no position in this. The other things that I would like to contribute is that a statement was made that there were no eyewitnesses talking about the approaching aircraft, either banking or yawing or flying slow. I ask everybody to review Middlebrook's, Bogar's, and Lagasse's information. Each of them explained that the aircraft was indeed banking and yawing and flying slow. To repeat, anybody who deals with the FDR and the radar data that has been presented and given and filtered through the U.S. government is doing so at their own risk.
Thank you, Robin. And Jim.
Wait. Do I get to respond?
No. That wasn't a question. That was just a comment.
It's a misleading comment. Now, I'll just make it really brief. If you take a look at the CIT's famous pictures of the flight paths, in order to make that those types of banks, any of those, you need to have the plane almost sideways in order to make the turns at those speeds. You can't do that. You would need a Martian spaceship to do it without turning. But an airplane dealing in the air with fluid mechanics has to turn sideways, very noticeable turn. Not wasn't happening. Thanks.
Okay. And Jim, last comment. Go ahead.
Yes, just one. I looked into ground effects in a lot of detail. If a plane was coming in at high speed, the ground effect is actually reduced. It's actually more pronounced at slow landing speeds, about a 40% reduction. The other thing is, too, I was wondering if we could form a research group that could look at each of the witnesses and where each person in the group would be given one witness to be able to research so that we can get all relevant information about that witness and compile it so that we have a non-biased or hopefully non-biased presentation of the testimonies of all the witnesses.
Okay, well, the last question, that would have to be something that you would put on the agenda and we could discuss it at another time, okay?
Okay.
You can do that whenever you wish. Okay. So, once again, thanks to our participants in the debate tonight, all of whom conducted themselves very professionally and with quite a bit of information on both sides. I remind everyone again to please go to the link and give your feedback on tonight's debate, and then we will publish the results of the feedback this in about a week. You have about a week to respond to that. One moment, please.
Can I make a quick announcement?
Mm. No, not yet. We do announcements at the end.
Mm. Okay.
Uh-huh. And now we're ready for our special guest tonight, if I can bring up the agenda.
Oh, just a minute. Excuse me. What about the third debate discussion?
I'm sorry?
Well,
you're right, Barbara. Yeah, no, good point. You're right. We have 5 minutes reserved for the possibility of a next debate challenge. And if anybody wants to volunteer to...
I'm on the stack, Barbara.
Debate. All right, Barbara. And who else?
Well, Craig, I'll go on the stack.
Craig, okay. Who else? All right.
Adam, I'll go on the stack.
And Rob? Okay.
Tim. Yeah.
And Tim? Okay. All right, Barbara, go ahead.
I'm sorry, did you say me?
Yes, Barbara, yes.
Oh, thank you, I couldn't hear. Yeah, well, I propose and I make a motion that there be a third debate between myself and Craig and or Adam, and at this time that we actually debate what was supposed to be debated tonight, which is the proposition no plane was destroyed by any means at the Pentagon on 9/11, instead of the proposition that was debated tonight by Craig and Adam with Wayne, which is no plane at the Pentagon. That's a completely different proposition. So I make a motion, and I would hope for a second that we have a third debate, seeing as I won the last debate.
Before we wait for a second,
I would like to debate Craig and Adam next time.
Yeah, before we ask for a second, are Craig or Adam willing to debate Barbara on this question? I take it, Barbara, that you would want to debate that no plane was destroyed?
Yes, that was supposed to be the proposition tonight.
Well, then you're requesting that Craig and Adam takes the other side of that question?
That's correct.
Okay. Craig and Adam, are you up to doing that?
Well, I would take the position that a plane was destroyed at the Pentagon.
Ah.
And they would, of course, take the position that one was not.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. So the glove is thrown. So, do you guys want to take that one up for next round?
Well, I just want to say I'm all for doing that. I don't know that I can commit to doing it in time for the next call, though. I spent a great deal of the month of January working on this to the exclusion of just about everything else. I don't know that I can do that again in February. As you know,
How about
March? You can do it in March. March is fine.
Would you go into it in March?
Well, yeah, I suppose. I mean, I would like to sort of. Why don't you see what Adam has to say, and then I can sort of. Because I was sort of hoping to take maybe a more secondary role, but.
Okay. So.
But in any case, I would be open to that, I guess. Yeah.
So, maybe we should postpone until April. Wouldn't that be better for you guys?
That would be fine with me. This is Adam Ruff talking. But our debate points aren't going to be really that drastically different. And if you look at our slide number one, we actually did address the exact debate question that Barbara's saying we didn't.
Okay.
It's just that our evidence proved both that there was no
Yeah. Yeah, but that was just Barbara's opinion. It's not necessarily a shared opinion, so we don't need to debate that here. We just want to know whether or not you guys want to take up the challenge of debating her on this question to make it a three-way, a third debate. Are you willing to do that in March or April?
I would be willing in March or April, yes. But it does take a lot of effort, and
I know that. You guys are all to be commended for the amount. Yeah, everyone should be commended for the amount of time and effort that was put into preparing this debate. Absolutely,
Mark,
it is a lot of work.
Fine with me. Either one would be
great. Okay, so Craig, do you have a preference?
I would probably prefer if everyone's open. I would prefer April. Given the fact that, you know, we agree on so many of these points that we would be investigating kind of new stuff.
Can we state this in the affirmative that a large plane was destroyed at the Pentagon?
That would be fine.
Sure.
Okay. All right, then. That is done, and we will schedule that for our April conference. Thank you all very much. And does anybody else have a request for a debate? There's three other people on the staff here. Craig, I guess you wouldn't have anything else to say, would you?
No, not especially, no.
Could you repeat that debate subject? I don't think that's what Barbara was talking about.
I'm sorry?
Could you repeat the debate topic? I don't think...
The debate topic, a large plane was destroyed at the Pentagon.
Well, I don't think either side would argue that.
Yes,
Barbara will.
Okay, I thought the plane you were talking about was smaller, so I didn't realize that was a large plane. Sorry.
Absolutely not. Large plane.
Okay, so Adam, you're next on the stack. If you have anything else to add?
Okay, Paul on the stack.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add is that many of our same points we used in this debate would go to address that question also.
That's fine.
Okay. And Tim, do you have anything to add?
Nothing to add.
Paul?
Yes, I just wanted to say we need to vote on this thing. It's not just a question of two people, three people agreeing.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah, you're right. That's some point of order, and we'll accept that. Do you have anything else to add?
No.
Okay. Then let's go ahead and say all in favor of putting the a large plane is destroyed at the Pentagon. Barbara taking the affirmative, and Craig and Adam taking the negative. For our April teleconference, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay.
Nay.
We do have a dissenter, but I think the clear majority is in favor of it, so we will go ahead and schedule that and move on to our next